Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. The former governors who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them for their daily ration 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also persevered in the work on this wall, and we acquired no land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox, six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the food allowance of the governor, because the service was too heavy on this people. Remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people. So as we open our Bibles together this morning, I'm going to ask you to sit with two questions. First, when you look at your life, you look at the things you're doing, you look at the things you're saying, the things you're pursuing, the things you're committed to, the relationships that you're invested in. When you look at the things you're spending your time, your money, your effort on, when you look at your life, are you doing the right things? Are you doing the right things? And then secondly, as you look at your life, but also look at your heart and consider your motivation for doing the things that you're doing, and your motivation for saying the things that you're saying, and for pursuing the things that you're pursuing, why you're committed to the things you're committed to, why you're investing in the relationships that you're investing in, why you're spending your time, your money, your effort on the things you're spending your time, your money, your effort on. As you look at your life and you look at your heart, are you doing the right things for the right reasons? And so are you doing the right things, and are you doing the right things for the right reasons? We're going to think through those two questions together this morning, because as we re-engage the book of Nehemiah, it's just been undeniably clear that this man, Nehemiah, has been filling his life up with the right things, namely the mission of God in the world. But the text also reveals he's been filling his life up with the right things, the mission of God in the world for the right reasons, the glory of God alone. And so this morning's text is going to challenge us by way of Nehemiah's testimony to take on the right things, God's mission in the world, even here on the North Shore, and to do so for the right reasons, the glory of Jesus Christ. And so let's dive into the text together. And as we do, and we begin considering what it might look like when we fill our lives up with the right things, and we're going to consider that. And as we do, the first encouragement we are going to pull out of the text together is to take up the mission of God, to fill our lives up with the right things, to take up the mission of God. And so as we step back into Nehemiah chapter 5, let's just recall that Nehemiah all along throughout our study has already been filling his life up with the right things by investing in the mission of God. And so as we look to the text, verse 14 is going to resituate us in the narrative. Let's look there. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years. And so while the book of Nehemiah as a whole is going to chronicle really what's just a sliver of Nehemiah's time serving as the governor of Judea, he is now later on reflecting back on that time, which spanned from 445 to 433 BC, right around 12 years. And man, even from the fraction that is revealed in front of us, we know it has been an eventful stint as the governor. And throughout it, one of the defining marks of Nehemiah's service as the governor of Judea has been this commitment to God's work. We've seen that all along, right? Leading up to Nehemiah arriving in Jerusalem, we understand the people of God have been living off in exile. And waves of these people returned to the promised land before Nehemiah with this intention to reestablish a life there. Man, it has been a tough road for them. And so as the book of Nehemiah opens, Nehemiah, who's still living in exile, receives word that those who have returned before him are living in trouble and shame, and that the walls of Jerusalem remain broken down. And so eventually, by the grace and providence of God, Nehemiah is granted favor to travel to Jerusalem to lead this effort to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and to serve the people. And so he has moved across the known world. He has picked up his life, leaving everything he's ever known, and dropped it in a foreign place to take on God's mission. And as he's taken up this focused commitment to God's work, Nehemiah has also invested himself in leading others to invest themselves in God's purposes. And so Nehemiah finally arrives in Jerusalem, and he rests, and he inspects the project's need, and then he mobilizes the people around this good work of building up the walls of Jerusalem. And so as Nehemiah continues that investment in God's mission, he's giving his time, he's giving his effort, he's giving his energy to combat and to troubleshoot this whole variety of complex things that pop up along the way, which inevitably come when we attempt to do something great for the Lord in this life. And that, of course, begins with opposition. And so while the people begin working, threatening opposition rises up, discouraging them, speaking lies into their life, threatening to kill them and to stop the work. And as this opposition raises, Nehemiah only digs his heels in even more, turning the people time after time after time back to the Lord in faithfulness, back to the Lord in prayer, back to the Lord in remembrance, encouraging them to continue moving forward, attempting this great thing for God, building and now also guarding the walls of Jerusalem. And so while all of that is going on, chapter 5, verses 1 to 11, which we looked at last time, revealed that the mission is going to get even more complex, and yet Nehemiah continues filling his life up with the right things. Some of those complexities are just the pure fact that the scope and scale of this project's demands are going to combine with a series of other factors like a famine in the land and the fact that the Persian king is taxing the people, and all of that comes together and it becomes this perfect storm of financial and practical burden that is crushing these people who are working on the wall. And so Nehemiah has to step into it, and he's got to manage his way through all of that. He's got to address this stuff, and while Nehemiah continues leading the people through all of those complexities, he comes to find out that the wealthier Jews among them are having to loan money to those brothers and sisters who are in need, but they're charging them interest, and they shouldn't be. And they're positioning themselves to be on the receiving end of those weaker brothers and sisters having to mortgage their lands just to buy grain to survive. And they're even receiving their kids as debt slaves. And so as these wealthier Jews are taking on this wonderful work of building up the walls of Jerusalem, they're getting rich at the expense of their weaker brothers and sisters, and this is without a doubt sin. And so Nehemiah steps in, and he addresses the people, and once again he's turning them to faithfulness and to faithfulness to the Lord, and he's turning them to remember his promises. He's turning them to repentance that they might move forward in obedience. And so as difficult, as trying, as complex, as uncomfortable, as sticky as God's work and his mission has been, Nehemiah has taken one faith step after another. He's taken on one issue after another, devoting himself wholly to God's work. When we look at his life, the things that he's doing, the things that he's saying, the things he's pursuing, the things he's committed to, the relationships he's invested in, when we look at the way he's spending his time, his money, his effort, it is so crystal clear he's doing the right things. He's taking on the mission of God. And so Nehemiah has been doing the right things all along by investing his life in God's mission. And that example is only further sharpened in this morning's text. Here's the first evidence that we're going to see in the latter half of chapter 5, that Nehemiah continues committing himself to the mission of God. Here's the first marker of that. He's making sacrifices rather than pursuing his own comfort. He's making sacrifices rather than pursuing his own comfort. And to grasp how real that is in our text, first we have to understand what some of his rights were as the governor of Judea. And so let's turn back to verses 14 and 15 quickly. "Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, From the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years. Neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. The former governors who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them for their daily ration 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people. And so as governor, Nehemiah held this responsibility to tax the people. He had to tax them on behalf of the Persian Empire. And no doubt he couldn't wiggle his way out of imposing that tax. Verse 4 is going to suggest he actually had to impose that tax. But in addition to administering the tax for the Persians, as the governor, Nehemiah also held this right to tax the people in order to collect for himself. That as governor, he might increase his own personal wealth through more taxation on the people. This was his right. This was a normal, well-established practice. In fact, Nehemiah makes a point to say former governors did exactly that. Right? These former governors, they imposed this 40 shekel of silver per day tax on the people. It was this crazy burden on them. And it was imposed in order to support the governor's own lavish lifestyle. And so the baseline worldly expectation for someone sitting in Nehemiah's seat is to burden the people for his own establishment. It's to collect from them in order to eat the good stuff himself. It's to make them increasingly uncomfortable for the sake of his own personal comfort. That's the norm. It was normal in Nehemiah's world to serve, even in great ways, with selfish motives. And without a doubt, the same is true in our world. It is normal for us to orient our lives in such a way where we are pursuing our own comfort first and foremost. It's normal for us to build retirement accounts and to go on fancy vacations and to eat at fancy restaurants and to live what the world calls the good life just to make ourselves as comfortable as possible on this earth. That's normal for us as well. And maybe you feel it today. Maybe living on the North Shore, you know what it's like to be on that hamster wheel, perpetually running towards a more and more comfortable life. Well, Nehemiah is in a position to directly achieve all of those comforts that the world tells us we need. Right? That the world dangles in front of us like the carrot we all must attain. He's right there. He just has to reach out and take it. And the world's comforts are his. He just has to impose that tax. And yet Nehemiah forgoes that right. He sacrifices his own comfort. He lays down that privilege. He's breaking that worldly norm. And this is tremendous evidence that he's filling his life up with the right things. Verse 14 says, "Neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor." Nehemiah says, "Yeah, I know that my job allows for me to tax the people so that I can eat better, but I'm not in it for that. I'm not serving as the governor for the fringe benefits. I'm not building this wall for my own profit. I'm not engaging the mission of God, using my time on earth to accomplish something for him just to make my time on earth more opulent or physically prosperous in some sort of way. I'm not in it for that. Not in the mission for that," he says. And so the first evidence in the text that Nehemiah is committing himself to the right things is that he's making sacrifices rather than pursuing his own comfort. Here's another evidence. Really, it's just another way of looking at that same truth. He isn't working for earthly gain. He's not living for earthly comfort, and he's not working for earthly gain. And so when we continue to look at Nehemiah's life, at the things he's doing, at the things he's saying, at the things he's pursuing, at the things he's committed to, at the relationships he's invested in, at the way he's spending his time, his money, his energy, when we look at his life, it's clear he's doing the right things because he stepped off that hamster wheel. He's looking beyond that carrot, and he is not distracted by the treasures of the here and now. Right? Nehemiah is working, but he's not working for earthly gain. That shows up in this morning's passage in a number of places. First, he's committing his time and his effort for the mission. Look at verse 16. "I also persevered in the work on this wall, and we acquired no land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work." And so he's working, even as the governor. He's getting his hands dirty. He's working for the Lord. He's working. He's committing his time and his effort for the Lord. And despite his work, despite his position, what is he not doing? He's not acquiring land for himself. Very simply, his focus is not to build his own assets in the mission. That's not why he's committing himself. Another way Nehemiah works, but not for earthly gain, is with the way he invests his resources. One of the major resources at his disposal, as clarified in the text, are his servants. These are people he can employ any number of ways. And what does he not do with these servants? He's not sending them out to collect taxes for himself. Right? When describing the activity of those former governors in verse 15, and the text says, even their servants lorded it over the people, he means that these former governors gave their servants the authority to go around and to collect more taxes from the people. And in verse 16, we learn not only is Nehemiah not using his servants for that, not only is he disallowing them to lord their position over the people and to collect more taxes, but instead he's committing them to work instead on the wall. And so here's what's happening. He's directing those in his charge not to use their time and effort for his own gain, but for the sake of God's mission and his work. But Nehemiah's conviction to work and yet to work not for earthly gain does not end there. In addition, the fact that he isn't burdening the people with more taxes means that he's footing the bill for all the leadership expenses out of his own pocket. And so he's also committing his finances to the mission. Look at verses 17 and 18. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that was what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox and six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the food allowance of the governor. And so as governor, Nehemiah had the right to impose taxes on the people, but he also had this responsibility to host and to entertain, to provide for a bunch of other leaders and officials and diplomats. In fact, it was his responsibility to feed and provide for 150 grown men, plus foreign leaders who are making visits at various times. And so we're beginning to see that the governor's tax didn't all go straight into the governor's pocket. Quite a bit of it was used to pay for these obligations. And yet foregoing the tax and still having to provide for that large group, it means that Nehemiah is eating the bill. And it's no small price. As we all know, when you go to the grocery store, it is not cheap to eat, right? I have a family of six, and my wife does the grocery shopping. I'm really grateful for that. She is, I will say, a dynamic shopper. She can sniff out a deal from a mile away. When she goes grocery shopping, she does this tour of like five grocery stores. From Costco to Market Basket, she is aware of what deals happen when, and she does everything she can to keep the cost of the groceries as low as possible. And yet, as we all know, man, it is not cheap to feed a family, right? Nehemiah has 150 grown men at his table. And so every day, one ox, six sheep, birds, every 10 days, all kinds of wine abundant. It's like he's throwing a wedding every day. That's a massive amount of food. This is a massive amount of resource. This is a massive amount of expense. And so Nehemiah's not poor by any stretch of the imagination. He's well off, but generously willing to commit what the Lord has put into his care back to the Lord for the sake of the mission. In fact, Nehemiah spends lavishly. He spends lavishly of himself for the sake of these people and for the sake of God's work. And so when we look at his life, how he's doing the right things, we see this life that is marked by time and effort and energy and resource and finance that is devoted to the purposes of God. And the continual consideration for us throughout our study of Nehemiah has been, okay, I see that in the text. I see how true this was of Nehemiah. But can I look at myself and say the same is true of me? Are our lives marked like that? First of all, are we even engaging the mission of God in the world? Just as God gave Nehemiah and the people this mission, this job of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, he has given us a mission to go into the world and to make disciples. Have we thought about this week that there are souls living and dying all around us without the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ? The reality of that ought to burden us. The reality of that ought to sit heavy on us. There ought to be an urgency in us when we think about how real that is. And as the Apostle Paul's logic goes in Romans 10, for everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved by the grace of God. When God draws a sinner to himself in faith and that person trusts in Jesus, God is faithful to save that person. The people living and dying all around us, they need Jesus, they need Christ, they need to hear the gospel, they need the God of heaven to pour his grace over them and to forgive their sin and to cover them in the righteousness of Jesus Christ and to welcome them into his family and to save their souls forever. That's what our neighbors need. Cornerstone, the mission is real. And yet as the logic goes, Romans 10, how then will they call on him of whom they have never believed? How are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? How are they to hear without someone preaching? How are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. Our mission is to use our lives, to use our time that God has given us on this earth to help other people know and follow Jesus. That's why we're here. But they need to call on Jesus in faith to be saved, which means we have got to go and preach the gospel to them. Are we? Are we even engaging in the mission? Our days fill up quickly, but when we take this inventory of our lives, do we even see the mission of God has a place in there? Are we prioritizing God's work? Are we committed to prayer? Are we discipling other people? Are we reaching our neighbors? Are the things that we're doing, are the things that we're saying, the things we're pursuing, the things we're committed to, the relationships we're invested in, is the way we're spending our time and effort and money and resources? When we look at our lives, are we doing the right things? Are our lives filled up with the mission of God? And as we take up God's mission, are we doing so only as long as the mission doesn't infringe on our own comfort and gain, or are we doing so with a willingness like Nehemiah to sacrifice our privileges, to lay down our rights, to lay down our comforts, to lay down our gain for the sake of the work God has given us? Do our lives reflect an eagerness to press on through hard, discouraging, complex issues for the sake of building healthy ministry here like Nehemiah built the wall? Are we willing to sacrifice our status in our workplaces and our neighborhoods because we just can't stop talking about Jesus? Are we willing to cut into our personal time to build relationships with people and to wash others in the Word? Will we fill up our lives with decisions and activities and actions and words and priorities and commitments that don't revolve around us, because we're people who take seriously this privilege of doing the work of God, proclaiming Christ, making disciples on the North Shore? Are our lives marked by legs eager to step off that hamster wheel? Are our lives marked by eyes eager to look beyond that carrot? Are our lives marked by time, effort, resources, finances devoted to God and his work? And so as we inspect our lives, the encouragement is to take up the mission of God with lives painted by all these wonderful colors of fruitfulness. May it be so for us. And yet as we sit with that question, we marinate on whether or not we're doing the right things. There was another question to consider. Are we doing the right things for the right reasons? And as we consider the right reasons for doing the right things, the encouragement is to take up the mission of God for God. To take up the mission of God for God. So let's hop back into verse 15. You may notice we conveniently skipped over a chunk of that verse. We're going to go back to it. After confessing that he didn't eat the governor's tax, that he was not burdening the people, he was not eating the food allowance, all that stuff, Nehemiah is now going to tell us why. And so we're going to drill down beyond the crust of Nehemiah's actions to the core of his heart motivations. And as we do, the text records Nehemiah's reason for filling his life up with these good and these right actions. It wasn't himself. It wasn't just a leadership responsibility. It wasn't different practicalities. It was God. He did what he did. He lived how he lived because this man feared the Lord at a heart level. Verse 15, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. A reverence for God is motivating his life. We spent a little time in our last time together talking about the fear of God as this governing principle that rules the people of God. And so let's just take a moment here and remember that fear of the Lord is less about experiencing a terror before God, right? Although there are certain instances in Scripture where sinners come before the Almighty Holy God of heaven and tremble in terror because he is a fearsome God. But when the Bible talks about God's people walking in the fear of the Lord, it means that we live our lives with awestruck, reverent devotion for him gripping us. Martin Luther, back in the day, made this distinction between two different types of fear, what he called servile fear and what he called filial fear. Servile fear is the fear of judgment. This is the sort of fear that a slave would know before a harsh master. You're just fearful all the time of the judgment that's coming. But filial fear is the fear a child would have before a good, authoritative father. You love that father. You respect that father. You understand the authority that father holds over you, and you want to please that father. Christians, we know him as our just and merciful God who loves us, who judges us. We believe he is big. We believe he is supreme. We believe he is sovereign. We believe he is this all-powerful, perfectly holy creator, king, and father who has made us his children. And as we've encountered him, we've come to know that before him, our small, sinful, finite selves, we just have to submit to his authority as the one who loves us in bigger ways than we'll ever know. In a similar way to the way a toddler would submit to her dad. And so when the fear of God grips God's people, we're recognizing who God is and what he can do. We understand his total authority over us. And we respond with awe, and we want to please him, and we want to respect him and revere him in all that we do. He's our good father and God. And so if he has declared it, then it is so, and we submit and we bend our will with reverence and fearfulness to his. And that's what's happening in the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is operating with this heart that's filled up with awestruck filial fear as a child who knows this great God as father, as king, as creator, as judge, as savior, as a servant who's found substantially more pleasure in God himself than in the pleasures of the world. And so in the midst of the world, dangling that carrot of riches and food and decadence in front of him, fearing God is what is keeping Nehemiah in check. It's sort of like bowling with bumpers on it. I went bowling. Kristen and I had a date night on Friday. We went bowling. I go bowling typically once a year. I'm sore for like a week after. And so we went bowling, and both of us just could not find our form in the first game. She started off strong. I had two strings with no pins, and I roared back to a 77-75 win, which is not a good bowling score. But I did beat her, thankfully. But this is like bowling with bumpers. When the temptation to veer into the gutter comes, the bumper bumps the ball down the center of the lane where it belongs. I could have used some of those on Friday. Because Nehemiah fears God, he's eagerly sacrificing his rights and his privileges. Because he fears God, the fear of the Lord is driving him not to exercise his authority. The fear of the Lord is driving him to destroy the idol of self. The fear of the Lord is causing him to lay down his comfort. The fear of the Lord is causing him to no longer pursue his own gain. All of these things are real in his life because the man fears God. Because he's standing before God and he's relating to God with this awestruck reverence. You're my Father and I submit to you. That's what's happening at the heart level that's driving his living. And so let's own the fact that this awestruck fear of the Lord is healthy. This is good and a reverent desire to bend to him in order to please him, in order to glorify him. It's the right reason for doing the right things. And so as the fear of the Lord lives in Nehemiah and serves as this bumper that's bumping him out of the gutters and down the lane where he belongs, there's another motivation that pops up in the text that's driving his living, and it's the welfare of the people. As he says, no thanks to earthly gain at the expense of his own cost and his time and his resources, we learn at the tail end of verse 18, it's because the service was too heavy on this people. Now remember, the people have been burdened. And yet in the fear of the Lord, Nehemiah cares more about them than he cares about him. There's the love of God for them that's more real in his heart than the love for him is. And so he's treating them the way he would have someone else treat him. And so Nehemiah's motives for doing the right things are reverence, desire, love for God, and love for people. His reason for living this way, for doing the right things, is a fearful love of God and love of people. Nehemiah's life is filled up with the right things because he loves God and because he loves people. It's the great commandment. He's living with the great commandment as this guiding, motivating anchor in his life. In Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 and 38, after this self-righteous lawyer approaches Jesus to test him with a question, which is the greatest commandment in the law, Jesus responds like this, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. Jesus is emphasizing keeping the whole witness of Scripture, living God-honoring lives. It hinges on people living with those two motivations, a love for God that's bumper over here and a love for neighbor that's the bumper over here. The great commandment has taken residence in Nehemiah's heart, and because he loves and he fears God, and because he loves his neighbor, he's not exercising the authority that he might. He's not taking advantage of them for his own gain. His living is markedly different because those two motivations are real in him. And so as we think about doing the right things for the right reasons, we know there are a lot of people out there living their lives, trying to do quote-unquote good things by the world's standard, right? There are a lot of people in our world who are living like Nehemiah. You don't have to be a God-fearing Christian in order to sacrifice something for someone else. You don't have to be a God-fearing Christian in order to work for the well-being of your community. The world is full of social justice organizations who do good things. But as we know, if these good things are done apart from Christ, and if they're done for any reason other than the glory of God, then all our righteous deeds are like filthy rags. As the prophet Isaiah has said, Nehemiah is different because he did what he did, the way he did it, because God got a hold of his heart, and because he cared most about God and his glory. And this man existed to please God, and he's blessing, and he's loving, and he's sacrificing for other people because he sought the glory of God first. This is why he prays what he prayed in verse 19. Remember for my good, O my God, all that I've done for this people. This is just another one of Nehemiah's prayers. They're sprinkled all throughout the book of Nehemiah. The prayer is such a theme of the book. And it's obvious from this prayer that Nehemiah has found worth and pleasure in one who is more glorious than anything the world can offer, and that is the God of heaven. It's obvious that Nehemiah finds satisfaction in God, not elsewhere, that he's motivated to please God, not anyone else. He's finding pleasure in God's favor, not in doing good things and just making people feel good. He's looking to God to justify and vindicate him. He's not looking for justification and vindication anywhere else. God is his primary concern, so God is the one to whom he ultimately appeals. And when we're in this mission for the Lord and not for ourselves, when this fearful reverence and love for God is the bumper over here keeping us in the lane, and love for neighbor is the bumper over here keeping us out of the gutter and keeping us in the lane, when those things are real, our lives too are going to be poured out for the sake of Jesus and neighbor. And we too are going to be perfectly okay making decisions like the ones we see Nehemiah making throughout the book. And our lives are going to be worship that will please our great and mighty God to the end of his glory. And so take a moment this morning, look at your life, and look at your heart, and consider, are you doing the right things for the right reasons? Even this morning, are we coming to church? Are we singing these songs? Are you sitting through a sermon? Taking communion when we have communion? Are we doing these things week after week because it seems like the right religious thing to do, or because the fearful love of God grips you? Are we starting our days each day reading our Bibles and praying because we feel some sort of obligation to check that off our to-do list, or because our souls are desperate for God? Are we serving through, whether it be the ministries of the church or just out in our daily lives, because we want to help people in some socially conscious way, or because the grace of God compels us to love them the way he has loved us? Are we keeping our wedding vows? Are we making ethical choices at work or at school because we fear what others will say of us if we don't, or because we fear the God of heaven and understand our lives and our obedience, our worship, because we want to live lives that bring him honor? Are we doing the right things, or are we filling our lives up with the mission of God, and are we doing the right things for the right reasons, the glory of Christ? So we've spent our time this morning thinking through those two questions with our Bibles open. Are we doing the right things? Are we doing the right things for the right reasons? And yet we must inevitably land in this place of recognizing that while we might be able to leave this place, walk through those double doors, go out into the world, into our lives, and try to do some good moral things this afternoon, we cannot take up the mission of God for God. We just can't do it in and of ourselves. Because as the scriptures reveal, we are all sinners. And as sinners, we can't naturally love God. We can't naturally commit our lives to him. We can't naturally desire his glory. In fact, our sin separates us from God. Our sin declares us spiritually dead, unable to offer anything to him. The best efforts and yet inevitably woeful efforts of our filthy rags. It's the best we can offer him on our own. And so it's clear that we may only take up the mission of God for God thanks to Jesus. You see, thankfully, while we were dead in our sin, while we were unable to love God, while we are unable to love our neighbor, while we were trusting in our own righteousness to save us, Jesus came. And he lived this perfect life we never could have lived. And he died the death that we deserved. And he paid our debt on the cross. And he rose from the grave in victory to save us from our sin. Thankfully, Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. But he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men and being found in human form. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And thankfully, on the cross, Jesus laid down his kingly right. Thankfully, on the cross, Jesus laid down his privileges. He became sin for us. Thankfully, on the cross, Jesus incurs the cost of our sin. Thankfully, he spends himself lavishly in love for his Father and in love for us. Thankfully, on the cross, Jesus sacrificed his comfort for our eternal comfort. Thankfully, Jesus turned down the kingdoms of the world, working for heavenly glory rather than earthly glory. And thankfully, when we turn to Jesus in faith, by the grace of God, he forgives our sin. He replaces our hearts of stone with hearts of flesh. He covers us with his righteousness, and he sets the sinner free to love him and to love neighbor truly, that we might live lives full of the right things, full of the right reasons. But it's only thanks to Jesus. And so ultimately, this text in Nehemiah 5, it's driving us to the foot of the cross. It's driving us to Jesus, the one whom we all desperately need, to turn to him in faith for the strength that we need to live like Nehemiah. And so let's fill up our lives with the right things for the right reasons. Let's take up the mission of God for God, but only thanks to Jesus. So at this time, I'm going to invite the praise team forward. And church, as we prepare to close our time together, let's worship the God of our salvation, praising Jesus for giving us the fearful, the reverent, the submissive, love-soaked hearts that we need to live lives that glorify him. Join me in a word of